amount of something you need, you have an exiguous amount, meager or scanty. Certainly not enough. I mean, write it down as a math equation. Exiguous is less than the exact amount. Use the math less than sign if that helps you. Now also, connect exiguous to a time that you didn't have sufficient resources to do something. Perhaps the exiguous memory on your old computer wasn't enough to run a new application. Or, an exiguous meal that you had with your grandparents that just consisted of a few watery vegetables and some noodles that didn't even come close to filling you up. Your stomach was still rumbling after that exiguous dinner. Write this connection down in your vocabulary notebook and try to fill up before your next exiguous meal. Okay, our next target word is diminuendo. What do you think diminuendo might mean? Is it A, an implication, a double meaning, or a subtext? Or B, a decrease in loudness or intensity, the opposite of a crescendo, a decrescendo? Well, before we go to the definition, see if these two contexts help you out. In illuminated manuscripts, the use of a large capital letter followed by smaller text is said to create a diminuendo effect. And the diminuendo chorus at the end of the movement leaves listeners with a haunted feeling. So as you can see, the answer is B, diminuendo, is a noun referring to a decrease in loudness or intensity. Now, how can you remember diminuendo? Well, diminuendo was also the name of a thoroughbred racehorse back in the 1980s. She had a good run. Pardon the pun. You know by now that I can't help myself. Now, she won 4 races in a row in 1988 and was favored to win the St. Leger Stakes in Britain. She finished 2nd there, though, and then failed to place at all in her final race in France. And after that, she was put out to pasture. You might say the end of her racing career lived up to her name, diminuendo. The racehorse gradually faded and decreased in success. Now, the etymology of diminuendo can also help us remember its meaning. Diminuire is an Italian verb meaning to diminish. And the endo at the endo is basically the Italian version of the ing that we use in English as a suffix for gerunds and participles. So, highlight the D-I-M-I-N in diminuendo and connect it to the related word diminish in your vocabulary notebook. Write down that a diminuendo refers to a diminishing loudness or intensity. Diminuendo, diminish. There's our related word strategy at work again. And if you remember diminuendo this way, you won't forget it. All right, before we move on, let's take another look at diminuendo. And specifically, let's look at the min morpheme. What do you think it means? Well, min is a Latin root meaning small. And our key word for min will be minuscule. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook. A minuscule raise is one you won't notice because it's so small. And listen to all these other familiar words derived from this productive min root. Mince, minor, minuscule, minimum, minus, minute, diminish, and diminutive. When you mince something, you chop it into small bits. And a minor is someone who is junior or smaller in age. And let's take a closer look at the etymology of minute from the Latin minutus, meaning small. Now, although the Babylonians were working with a sexagesimal, base 60 mathematics, long before him, it was Ptolemy, whose works were translated from Greek into Latin during the Middle Ages, who gave us the term minute. Pars minuta prima, the first small part, or 1/60th of a circle. And second, pars minuta secunda, the second small part, or 1/60th of a minute. Okay, let's move on from the Latin root min to our next two target words. And for these two, we need to go all the way back to England in 1726, which was the publication year of Jonathan Swift's classic biting satire, Gulliver's Travels. Now, if you remember, the central character in this book, Lemuel Gulliver, was an English surgeon whose business was failing. So, he took to traveling the seas. And soon after setting out, Gulliver is shipwrecked. And when he awakens, he finds himself tied up by a race of tiny people, the Lilliputians. The Lilliputians are small people who talk big. And Jonathan Swift, with great skill, ironically contrasts this puny race with their big, puffed up, pretentious, vainglorious, boasting, and bloviating bombast. It's the Napoleon complex before Napoleon. Now, eventually, the Lilliputians take Gulliver to their emperor. And as the story unfolds, we discover that the Lilliputians engage in a lot of backbiting and machinations. These physically small people are also figuratively small. They're petty and argue over trivial, ridiculous issues. Okay, now the Lilliputians are at war with the equally small people of Blefuscu. And do you remember what the conflict was over? Get this. The important doctrinal differences of how to properly crack an egg. The big Endians were for cracking the egg on the big side. And the small Endians were for cracking an egg on the small side. And Swift was satirizing what he saw as petty religious quarrels over trivial doctrinal issues of the time. Again, another example of a small, petty people arguing over small, petty things. Now, the Lilliputians eventually convinced Gulliver to help them fight against the people of Blefuscu, and he uses his great size to win a battle over their navy. However, Gulliver's fortunes turn when a fire breaks out in the royal palace of Lilliput, and he puts the fire out by urinating on it. And for this act, he is condemned to death by being shot in the eyes and starved to death. But luckily, Gulliver escapes and makes his way back home to England with his family. And so, all of this brings us to our first target word that comes to English from Gulliver's Travels, Lilliputian. Now, Lilliputian is an adjective that has two important meanings. It can mean very small, diminutive, or it can mean trivial, petty, as in, compared to the refugees fleeing war-torn countries, our worries over what to order for dinner tonight are decidedly Lilliputian. Now, this word took off immediately after the publication of Gulliver's Travels, demonstrating that book's influence. And interestingly, Swift never explained how he conjured up this great word. So to remember Lilliputian, link it to little in your vocabulary notebook. And link it not just to something literally little and small, like a tiny figurine you may own, but also to someone or something which is figuratively little and small, like a petty twerp with a small moral character that lives down the block. All right, we're not through with Gulliver just yet. I mean, you'd think that after nearly getting executed, Gulliver would just stay home. But oh no, Gulliver decides he hasn't had enough fun yet and decides to take to the seas again. And this time, he ends up in the land of the giants, called the Brobdingnag, giants many times the size of Gulliver. A Brobdingnag farmer finds Gulliver. And after exploiting Gulliver by charging other giants to see this exotic, tiny creature, Gulliver becomes a sort of circus sideshow. The farmer eventually sells Gulliver to the queen of Brobdingnag, who takes a fancy to him. And at court, Gulliver sees the ordinary flaws of the giants magnified many times over because of their great size, and he becomes repulsed by them. I mean, for example, he's disgusted by the huge pores of their skin and the deafening sound of these giants urinating. And Swift is demonstrating that the human race, even humans who might appear perfect at first glance, will show foibles and flaws upon closer examination. I mean, we all have our problems that will come to light when our lives are placed under a magnifying glass, right? And this brings us to our second target word, Brobdingnagian. Brobdingnagian is an adjective that means immense, enormous, just like the giant race that Gulliver encountered. Now, always capitalize this word. And let's try this word in context. The billionaire's Brobdingnagian sculptures towered over us as we approached the front door of her mansion. Now, to remember Brobdingnagian, write down in your vocabulary notebook that it's a big, immense word, five syllables and a real jawbreaker to boot, for immense, enormous things. Okay, so say it with me in a deep, booming, giant-like voice. Brobdingnagian. I mean, it sounds big, immense, and a bit clunky, like a big, awkward giant stomping through your neighborhood. And remember Big Bob's ginormous size 16 shoes from the beginning of this lecture? Well, those shoes were definitely Brobdingnagian. And to answer the question from the beginning of this lecture, ginormous is a word in the dictionary. But use it informally. Probably not in a stuffy business meeting where you're looking to impress your boss. And ginormous is actually a portmanteau word, combining gigantic and enormous. And guess when its first known usage is? What do you think? Year 2000? The 1990s? 1980s? Actually, it was probably military slang from World War II. But it didn't really skyrocket in usage until the 1990s and the 2000s. Okay, Swift's two linguistic gifts to English, Lilliputian and Brobdingnagian, are the perfect segue for this point in our lecture, as they move us from the little to the big. So let's move from our Latin root min, meaning small, to a Latin-Greek root pair that both mean great and large, the Latin root magn and the Greek root mega. And our key word for magna is magnificent. To remember this magna root in your vocabulary notebook, write down that a magnificent painting is a great one. Okay, a couple more examples. Magnate. John D. Rockefeller, co-founder of Standard Oil, was an oil magnate. And Andrew Carnegie was a steel magnate. Both these magnates were the biggest, most influential players in their respective fields. And if you finished college with excellent grades, you might have graduated magna cum laude. And how about the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, which was signed by King John in 1215 and granted civil and political liberties to the English? And the word magnum? Well, magnum can refer to either a large bottle of wine or spirits or a firearm that uses a cartridge that is more powerful than the ordinary cartridge of the same caliber. And let's not forget about magnanimous, someone who has a great and noble spirit. Now, I mentioned my friend Big Bob at the beginning of this lecture. He is always giving of his time and energy to help out our family. Magnanimous people like Bob are courageous and generous. They are simply above showing any sort of pettiness. So if you're trying to be the better man, you're being magnanimous. Now, we also find this magna root in names like Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great, a sainted doctor of the Catholic Church, and Charlemagne, a.k.a. Charles the Great, emperor of the Carolingian Empire. So to remember the word, think of the magnanimity of a heroic prime minister, a great saint, or the father of Europe. And all of this magna talk brings us to our next target word, magnum opus. Okay, now we touched on this word in an earlier lecture when discussing the Latin root O-P-E-R meaning work, but you'll see it often enough that it's worth delving into a bit deeper here. So in this case, the definition and the etymology are one and the same. Magnum opus is simply Latin for great work. But we typically mean it to be an artist's greatest work. Think Michelangelo and the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, Wagner and the Nibelungenlied, Joyce and Ulysses. Big, expansive works, but also arguably their finest works as well. And to give you a sample sentence, Falling Water is widely regarded as Frank Lloyd Wright's magnum opus. And remember, the word opus is often used to describe composers' works. You might know Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 14 in C sharp minor, Opus 27 No. 2, better known as the Moonlight Sonata. So what's the plural of opus? Opuses? Maybe if you want to sound like someone who doesn't know Bellini from Rossini. Actually, it's opera, which makes the plural of magnum opus, magna opera. Now, synonyms for magnum opus include masterpiece, masterwork, and chef d'oeuvre. Now, like magna, M-A-G-N, Greek has its own root meaning great and large, mega. And mega comes from the Greek word megas, which just means great and large. However, in some contexts, it can mean something a little more specific, 1 million. So our key word for mega will be megaphone. And what does a megaphone do? It makes your voice sound large. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook. Perhaps with a picture of a megaphone as a visual clue for this big root. So, what other words are derived from mega? Well, how about megalopolis? A megalopolis is a huge city, typically one with a population larger than 10 million. Tokyo, Delhi, Seoul, Shanghai, Mexico City, and New York City are all among the top 10 megalopolises in the world. And if you live in one of these, you're a megalopolitan indeed. And in computing and electronics, we have the familiar megabyte, which is a million bytes of information storage, as well as megacycles, 1 million cycles, also known as a megahertz, and megohms, no A here, which is 1 million ohms. And colloquially, you can tack mega onto the front of almost anything to make it really big. I mean, if you've just won the lottery, you're probably rolling in megabucks. And let's not forget the megalomaniac we've probably all encountered. Someone in our lives who has an unfounded belief in their power, omnipotence, and overall greatness. And let's finish today's lecture with three more target words that don't include magna or mega, but that still relate to our general concept of big. Our next target word is commodious. Now, when you look at and hear the word commodious, what other related words do you think of? Don't be afraid to say it. Raise your hand if you said commode. Yes, as in the toilet kind of commode. So, do you think commodious is related to commode? Actually, it is. And it's a great way to remember it, too. But before I delve into this word history, let me tell you a family history that relates to this word. It's a bitter winter night in the late 1930s in Depression-era South Dakota. Glenn, my father-in-law, was a boy of 7 or 8 at the time. And growing up, they had no insulation in their house. And the winters were so cold, when they woke up in the mornings, their glasses of water would often be frozen. Now, Glenn's family also didn't have indoor plumbing. I mean, imagine, no indoor plumbing with temperatures plunging down to 20 degrees below zero. And if you had to go to the bathroom at night and you didn't want to freeze your backside off by trekking out to the outhouse, you used the chamber pot under the bed. Now, this particular night, Glenn's older brother, Lyle, used the chamber pot and while carrying it down the stairs the next morning to clean it out, tripped and spilled the contents all over himself. I know what you're thinking. Ugh. Now, Glenn's chamber pot was stored under the bed at night. It would have been a lot more convenient if they had a commode with indoor plumbing. And this idea of convenience brings us to the meaning, the original meaning of both commodious and commode. Because interestingly, both commodious and commode originally come from the same Latin word commodus, which meant proper, fit, appropriate, and convenient. Commodious first appeared in English in the early 15th century, meaning convenient. But it wasn't until the 16th century that it began carrying the present meaning of roomy and spacious. So, our target word commodious is an adjective, meaning comfortably or conveniently spacious, roomy. Now note that with commodious is not just spacious or roomy. There is the added connotation of spaciousness that is convenient, comfortable, and freed from constriction. Ah. So, where does the word commode come in? Well, the original Latin commodus passed into French as commode, meaning convenient and suitable, and was used to refer to both tall headdresses for women and chest of drawers. And in the 18th century, English borrowed this French word, using it to refer to a chest of drawers. But it wasn't until 1851 that commode started to be used to refer to a chair housing a chamber pot from the notion of convenience. I mean, isn't it a lot more convenient to have a chair housing your chamber pot, particularly with indoor plumbing included, than to have to reach under your bed to use a freestanding chamber pot at night? I mean, just ask my father-in-law's family about that. So, let's listen to commodious in context. I was happy to find that my new kitchen is equipped with a commodious pantry. Or, having expected a monk's cell, the grad student was surprised at how commodious his dorm room was. So remember, commodious doesn't just mean spacious and roomy, it means conveniently spacious and roomy, unrestrained. And to remember commodious, highlight the C-O-M-M-O-D in your vocabulary notebook and link it to the related word commode. Commodious, commode, conveniently spacious. Write down that a modern commode with indoor plumbing, especially a conveniently spacious bathroom, is a lot more convenient than little chamber pots and small outhouses. And this brings us to our next target word, a close synonym for commodious, capacious. Now, capacious is an adjective meaning capable of containing a great deal, spacious and roomy. So, like commodious, capacious means spacious and roomy. So what's the difference? Well, according to Merriam-Webster's Dictionary of Synonyms, capacious stresses the ability to hold more than the ordinary container can hold. So, if your Aunt Thelma has an extraordinary memory that could hold a lot more information than the average Joe, remembering the exact tie that your great uncle Leo wore at Christmas in 1941, you could say that she had a capacious memory. And note that you probably wouldn't use the word commodious to describe Aunt Thelma's memory, as you don't want to emphasize that her memory is conveniently or comfortably big, just that it can hold a lot. Now, capacious comes from the same Latin origin as capable, and capacious sounds like spacious. So, in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the C-A-P-A in capacious and connect it to capable by saying something that is capacious is capable of holding a lot. It's spacious. Pacious, capable, spacious. Remember that connection and you won't forget it. And once again, I've saved my favorite target word for last, juggernaut. Now it's a word you may know. And you may hear and read, but you may not use a lot. A juggernaut is a noun referring to an overwhelming or unstoppable force that smashes everything in its path. Here's juggernaut in action. 6'6" and 250 pounds at the tender age of 16, Tommy was a juggernaut on his high school football team. Now, a juggernaut could be a political or advertising campaign, a person, an institution, or a force of nature. Anything of immense power that can roll over anyone who tries to stop it is a juggernaut. Now, juggernaut is a Hobson Jobson of Jagannath, the name of one of the incarnations of the Hindu god Krishna. Now, in Sanskrit, Jagat means world or universe. And Natha, Lord, making Jagannath the Lord of the world. Sounds pretty overwhelming and unstoppable already, doesn't it? And the English word juggernaut dates back to the 1630s and originally referred to the huge wagons devotees would pull through the streets during the Rath Yatra, an annual chariot procession in the town of Puri. An early European account of the festival claimed that Hindus threw themselves beneath the wheels of the wagons. Though this is unlikely, it led to the word's two meanings in English. The older sense of something that demands blind devotion or sacrifice, and the more common modern sense of an unstoppable force. So, what is a Hobson-Jobson, you ask? Well, the law of Hobson-Jobson says that loan words are always phonetically adapted to suit the phonology of the language that's borrowing them. And the principle and the term come from a book called Hobson-Jobson, a glossary of colloquial Anglo-Indian words and phrases, and of kindred terms, etymological, historical, geographical, and discursive, published in 1886. Now, in short, Brits had difficulty pronouncing Jagannath, and so, when they borrowed the name to use it metaphorically, it morphed into the more English-friendly Juggernaut. And that brings us to the end of our lecture on big and small. And before our next lecture, you've got some homework. Try and find something that you had an exiguous amount of at home, like that meager supply of sugar left in your sugar bowl, and go replenish it. You might even want to buy a capacious, even a Brobdingnagian sugar bowl. But don't take a mega dose of sugar, or your eventual sugar crash will leave you with a diminished amount of energy. I'll see you next lecture.
Lecture 31, Spelling as a Vocabulary Tool.
Welcome to our lecture on spelling. Now, if we're going to talk about spelling, we've got to have a pretest, right? I mean, wasn't that what you did on Mondays in school to see which words you knew and which ones you needed to study? So I've got good news and bad news about our pretest. The good news is that there are only two words on this pretest. The bad news is that you have never seen or heard either of these two words before. How can I be so sure of this? Because I made the words up. They are nonsense words. I'll say each nonsense word a few times, and then I'll pause for a few seconds. If you can, spell the words in your vocabulary notebook. If not, just try and spell them out loud or visualize them. Okay, our first pretest word is fipping. Fipping. I like to go fipping on Friday nights. Try and spell fipping. Our second pretest word is fiping. Fiping. I said stop fiping and start your homework. Fiping. Okay, let's check ourselves. How did you spell our first word, fipping? Did you spell it F-I-P-P-I-N-G? With two P's in the middle? And how did you spell our second word? Fiping. Did you spell it F-I-P-I-N-G? With one P in the middle? Now, I've done this activity many times with many different audiences, and most adults spell both words correctly, even though they've never seen either word before. So why is this? Well, even though you may not be consciously aware of it, you've seen enough words like fipping and fiping to have gleaned two powerful spelling patterns in English. These two patterns can help us figure out whether to double a consonant or not double it at the juncture of two syllables. Let's start with the pattern in fipping. When you have a two-syllable word like fipping, in which the vowel in the first syllable is short, the following consonant is often doubled. That's why we have two P's with a short I, pronounced I, in fipping. Listen to three other two-syllable words in English that follow this short vowel doubling pattern. Better. Notice the short E in better, E, is followed by the doubled T. Rabbit. Notice the short A in rabbit, A, is followed by the doubled B. And sudden. Notice the short U in sudden, is followed by the doubled D. So here's the doubling pattern. When we have a short vowel in the first syllable of a two-syllable word, like rabbit, the following consonant is usually doubled. Okay, so what about fiping? Well, in contrast to the short I in fipping, fiping has a long I sound, I, right? So the pattern here is this. When you have a long vowel sound in the first syllable of a two-syllable word, the following consonant is usually not doubled. Listen to two other two-syllable words in English that follow this non-doubling long vowel pattern. Okay, first up, pilot. Notice the long I in pilot is followed by a single L. If we doubled the L in pilot, it would be pilot, right? And vacant. Notice the long A in vacant is followed by a single C. If we doubled the C in vacant, it would be vacant. So these two double or not two double patterns with short and long vowels are two high utility patterns that a host of words in English contain. Yes, there are some exceptions and some other syllable patterns, but the point I want to make is this. English has scores of spelling patterns just like this, making English a much more regular spelling system than most folks think. Now, throughout this course, we've been tapping into the spelling-meaning connection, specifically focusing on high-utility Latin and Greek affixes and roots to help us with our vocabulary. To get the most out of the spelling-meaning connection, it's very helpful to understand the two layers of spelling that provide the foundation for the spelling-meaning connection. In fact, the English spelling system contains three layers of information that we'll explore today. Alphabet, pattern, and meaning. When you see how all three layers work together, you'll have a better appreciation for the vocabulary that we've been learning. Because the English spelling system provides so much rich information about words. Let's start with the alphabet layer in our spelling system. Most kindergarten and first grade children are exploring this first layer as they learn to read and write. Now here's a personal story that illustrates how these young children see our language. Now for part of my dissertation research, I was assessing kindergarten children's phoneme awareness, which is their awareness of the separate sounds in spoken words. So for one of the activities, I would point to a picture of a cat and ask the child, "What sounds do you hear in cat?" And if the child could fully segment the word cat into its three separate phonemes, they would say, "K, a, t." However, I'll never forget this one kindergarten boy. When I asked him what sounds he heard in cat, he looked at me a bit puzzled, as if this was an obvious question, and replied, "Meow." Yes, it was a humorous response, but it tells us a lot. You see, children who have not yet cracked our alphabetic code, like that kindergartner, are not even aware of words as separate units of language that can be conceptualized and segmented into separate sounds. And while this seems like a simple insight to adults who can read, it's actually an incredibly abstract concept for children to grasp. But as this young boy continues to learn more about the alphabetic layer of our spelling system, he'll eventually be able to sound out and spell one-syllable short vowel words like mat. Have you ever seen a first-grade child attempting to spell a word like mat? You can see the child's lips stretching the word out into its three sounds or phonemes and trying to match each sound to a letter in the alphabet. Mat. So, a child learning this alphabetic layer believes that every letter makes a sound and that we read and spell words in a left-to-right linear fashion. This is the alphabetic layer of spelling at work. It's part of the spelling story, but it's not the whole story. Now, before we move on to the next layer, I'm going to give you another pretest. I'm going to give you a word as it was spelled by a kindergartner and see if you can figure out the actual word the child was trying to spell. Okay, ready? This child spelled the word Y-I-Z. Y-I-Z. So what word do you think the child was trying to spell with the letters Y-I-Z? Well, the child was trying to spell wise, as in a wise old man. So how can Y-I-Z spell wise? Well, it actually makes sense if you know a child's spelling logic. So let's break it down, starting with the end of the word. What sound do you hear at the end of wise? Say it with me. Wise. It's actually what we think of as a Z sound, isn't it? So the child's Z makes sense. And the middle vowel I in the middle makes sense too, right? I. And finally, what about the Y at the beginning of wise? I mean, that can't make sense, can it? Using the letter Y for the W sound? Actually, it makes perfect sense, and here's how. You see, this child is what we call a letter name speller. He thinks that the names of the letters tell you their sounds. This strategy works well for a lot of letters in the English alphabet, right? I mean, B makes the B sound when you say it. B, B. And S makes the sound when you say it. S. The names of these letters carry clues to their sounds. But it's not true for all the letters in our alphabet. And this is where a child's letter name spelling strategy actually breaks down. The child who spelled wise is trying to find a letter name that makes the w-w-w sound. The letter name W doesn't carry the w sound, does it? Say it with me. W, w. No. And of course, the letter that does carry the w sound is Y. Do you hear the w at the beginning of Y? That's why letter name children spell the w sound with the letter Y so often. Now, as long as children have been writing, they've been inventing their spellings like this. But no one had really figured it out until the early 1970s, when research by Carol Chomsky and Charles Reed provided the Rosetta Stone, the linguistic key that unlocked the systematic logic behind young children's invented spellings. And at roughly the same time, Edmund Henderson and his colleagues and students at the University of Virginia were putting up spellings on the walls of the McGuffey Reading Center. They were also looking for patterns and logic in children's spellings across a range of ages and grade levels. And Reed's findings enabled Henderson and his colleagues at UVA to interpret these spellings. Henderson and his colleagues then built on and extended Reed's work. And these Virginia spelling studies resulted in a comprehensive model of developmental word knowledge, of how our knowledge of words develops over time from young children to adults through three layers, from sound or alphabet to pattern to meaning. The three layers we are talking about in today's lecture. And this is where I come into the story, because I did my graduate work at UVA, where I learned about this developmental spelling theory and research. It was a wonderland for a word nerd like me. And to me, one of the many incredible insights I learned at UVA was the fact that the spelling development of children over time mirrors the historical development of English spelling over time. For example, Edmund Henderson referred to beginning spellers as Little Saxons because of the similarities between the way young children spell and how Anglo-Saxons spelled and wrote in Old English. In fact, the alphabetic layer in English was established during this time. And as the authors of Words Their Way put it, Old English was, and I quote, remarkably consistent in letter sound correspondence and used the alphabet to systematically represent speech sounds. Huh. That sounds remarkably similar to the way young children spell and read. One letter for each sound they hear, doesn't it? And this makes sense. The oldest words in English are those short, high-frequency Anglo-Saxon words like sun, moon, and day. And these Anglo-Saxon words are the very same high-frequency words that children learn to read and spell in the primary grades. And for another great example, let's compare a common first grade spelling of the word wife and an Anglo-Saxon spelling of wife. Both the young child and the Anglo-Saxon spelling for wife are the same, W-I-F. Pretty uncanny, huh? So, before we move on to the next layer, let's summarize what we learned about the alphabetic layer of English spelling. Okay, first, children in the alphabetic layer do have a tacit logic underlying their spelling. Their spelling makes linguistic sense. Second, children at this stage operate under the principle that every letter makes a sound. And you read and spell in a left-to-right linear fashion. And third, children in this stage have the same basic spelling logic as the Anglo-Saxons. Now, a lot of critics of our spelling system would have a stop right here, right at the alphabetic layer. You see, they believe that we should just spell the words the way they sound. They believe that a system based on a one-to-one correspondence between letters and sounds would be much better. Okay, let's try that out. What if we just spelled each word the way it sounded, with one letter for each sound? How would you spell the word hate if you hate someone? Well, you couldn't use the silent E because every letter has to make a sound, right? So you could spell hate as H-A-T. Oh, wait a minute. We already have a word for H-A-T, hat. So you can see why the alphabetic layer alone isn't enough. Now, a long vowel word like hate is a perfect example of how the next layer of spelling information comes into play, the pattern layer. The pattern layer layers on to the alphabetic layer. Now, notice a few things about the word hate that are different from the alphabetic layer. First, not every letter makes a sound. That E is silent, right? And second, the silent E is there for a very good reason. We say that the silent E makes the preceding vowel, in this case the A, stand for the long A sound as in A, not the short A sound as in A. This is an important concept in English orthography. We usually mark long vowel sounds, like the long A in cape, with a silent letter. And finally, let's try and read the word hate, but as a child in the previous stage, the alphabet layer might. One letter at a time. Let's see how that works. Okay, ready? Here we go. Ha-at-eh. Oh, by the time you get to the end of hate and realize that there is a silent E there, it's too late to go back and make that A long, isn't it? So, you've got to process the A-T-E ending in hate as the entire single pattern or chunk. And this is where the pattern layer comes in. When children reach this stage of development, they start processing whole chunks of common letter sequences or patterns together. And this is the big advance children make at this stage. You see, children at this stage of development realize a few things they did not know in the alphabet stage. First, every letter does not make a sound in English. There are some silent letters. Second, these silent letters provide important information, like marking another vowel as long. And third, children realize that the one letter at a time strategy isn't going to work for all words. So, they learn to read letters in frequently occurring chunks or patterns, processing entire parts of a word simultaneously. And a quick note, Many older students and even adults who struggle with literacy are caught in this pattern layer. They're still trying to figure it out. And when I work with these folks, it's very helpful to know where they are in development so I know what they are ready to learn next. So now that we're on the pattern layer, let's take another spelling test. Now don't worry. This test will involve two actual words, not nonsense words. And it'll give you a flavor for the type of patterns that we learn in this layer of spelling. Ready? How do you spell peach? I ate a peach that I picked from the tree. Peach. Now, how do you spell patch? The pirate had a patch over his eye. Patch. Did you spell peach with a C-H at the end? And patch with a T-C-H? Well, my question is this. When you have the ch sound at the end of a word, how do you know when to spell it C-H and when to spell it T-C-H? Do you know this pattern? Let's try a few other ch words to see if this helps you. Listen and see if you can find a pattern. Okay, ready? Roach, beach, and coach. And let's try a few TCH words. Ready? Patch, pitch, and botch. So did you notice a pattern? Did you notice a clue in the words to let you know when to spell the words TCH or CH? Okay, I'll say the two sets of three words again. Visualize their spellings as I say them. And I'm going to give you a hint this time. Listen for the sounds of the vowels in the middle of the words. Okay, ready? Here they are. Roach, beach, coach. And the second set, patch, pitch, botch. Do you detect a pattern? By now, you may have noticed another rather powerful spelling generalization. If the words have long vowel sounds, like roach, beach, and coach, the ch sound at the end will usually be spelled ch. And if the words are short vowel sounds, like patch, pitch, and botch, the ch sound at the end will probably be tch. Did you know this tch versus ch pattern? I sure didn't. And most adults I know don't know it either. Now, there are a few exceptions like such and rich. But even so, this is another powerful spelling pattern that demonstrates how regular English spelling actually is. So now, let's return to the history of English spelling. If Anglo-Saxon Old English was responsible for the alphabetic layer in English, where did all these patterns in this pattern layer come from? I'll give you a hint. It started in 1066. As you know, the Norman conquest led to a massive influx of French words in English. But you may not be aware that this, in turn, led to a host of new vowel sounds represented by new vowel patterns entering English with these words. So, many of our vowel patterns in English today come from this time. And students at this pattern stage start spelling eerily like little Anglo-Normans. I mean, for example, a child at this stage might spell the word sweet, as in a sweet tooth, as S-W-E-T-E. This is the exact same way Chaucer spelled sweet in the 1300s, S-W-E-T-E. And what's interesting to those of us in literacy is not that this child's sweet spelling is wrong, but how it demonstrates what the child does know. I mean, why did the child put the silent E at the end of sweet? Well, she knew that we can mark a long vowel with a silent letter, so she probably chose the pattern most familiar to her. No, it's not the correct pattern for this particular word, but it is an allowable English spelling pattern that marks a long vowel. And we call this using but confusing. Using one vowel pattern, but confusing it in another word. And this is a great sign. Because when a child is using but confusing a spelling feature, it means they are on the edge of figuring it out, and thus are ripe for instruction in that feature. And now we've reached the final layer of English spelling, the meaning layer. Situated on top of the sound and pattern layers, the meaning layer is the one that you already know. Throughout this course, we've tapped into the power of the meaning layer through our study of high-utility Latin and Greek affixes and roots. Think of all the roots we've examined in this course, such as side, size, meaning kill, and spect, meaning see. And we know how to apply the spelling, meaning connection. For example, when we notice the spelling of the root spect in a word like circumspect, it can be a big clue to the word's meaning. If we are circumspect, we look around and are cautious. So, if the alphabetic layer of our spelling system was established with the Anglo-Saxons in Old English, and if the pattern layer was established after the Norman conquest, when do you think all these classical roots in the meaning layer came into the English spelling system? You guessed it, during the Renaissance. The explosion of new knowledge created during the Renaissance created a new demand for new vocabulary. I mean, you need new words to represent your new ideas, right? And with the rediscovery and renewed interest in the Greek and Latin cultures, the affixes and roots of Latin and Greek seem like the perfect tools to meet this demand. Okay, let's explore a powerful spelling pattern in the meaning layer. I'm going to say four words. I want you to tell me what they all have in common. Okay, ready? Affordable, credible, visible, reasonable. What did you notice about all these words? Well, they all have the "able" suffix at the end, right? And this suffix means capable of or likely to. So if a couch is affordable to you, you are capable of buying it, right? However, I want you to notice something else. Sometimes we spell the able prefix as able, as in affordable, and sometimes we spell it as ible, as incredible. Able versus able. When do we use which one? Is there a pattern? Actually, there is. And it's another perfect example of the spelling meaning connection. So let's see if you can figure it out. Ready? First, I'm going to say some able words that are all spelled A-B-L-E. See if you can figure out what they all have in common. Affordable, reasonable, agreeable. I'll give you a hint. If you take the A-B-L-E suffix off of affordable, reasonable, and agreeable, what are you left with? Afford, reason, and agree, right? All right, keep that in mind, and let's do the same thing to three able words and see if we can figure out the difference. Here are three able words in which the suffix is spelled I-B-L-E. Credible, visible, and audible. Okay, if we take the able suffix off of these, what are we left with? Cred, meaning to believe, vis, meaning to see, and odd, meaning to hear. So, what's the difference between the able bases, afford, reason, and agree, and the ible bases, cred, vis, and odd? You've probably guessed it by now. It's the difference between actual standalone English base words and roots that cannot stand alone. So, here's our spelling generalization for able words. If you take the able off and are left with an actual standalone base word, like affordable, afford, the spelling will probably be able. If you take the able off and are left with a root that cannot stand alone, like cred, incredible, the spelling will probably be able. And here's a great way to remember it. If the base is able to stand alone as a word, it's probably able. And if the base is not able to stand alone because it's a root, it's probably able. Write that down in your vocabulary notebook under able, ible. That's a pretty powerful generalization that works for most able words. Now let's move on to our second able generalization. What about base words that end in E, like debate? How do we spell debatable? Well, since they are standalone base words, we know they probably end in able. They follow our generalization. But when we move from debate to debatable, do we drop the E at the end of debate when we add the able suffix? Or not? Well, debatable is one of the most common spelling demons in English. So to help you out, I'm going to list the base word and the able ending in some other words to see if you can figure the pattern out. Okay, debate, debatable, debatable. Dispose, disposable, disposable. And consume, consumable, consumable. So, did you notice what happened when we went from the base word to the able? We dropped the E. So here's our generalization that builds off of our first one. Base words that end in E will usually drop the E and add able. Now there are a few exceptions, particularly with words that have soft C's and G's like changeable. And if you're really interested in learning more about this, I highly recommend Words Their Way by Donald Baer, Marcia Invernizzi, Shane Templeton, and Francine Johnson. And since we're on the subject of great resources, let's discuss two more. The very first resource is the one we've created together, your vocabulary notebook. So as you come upon new affixes and roots and their derived words, write them down in their very own roots section in your vocabulary notebook. For example, you could have a section of your vocabulary notebook devoted to the able suffixes that we just examined. In this section, you could record the meaning of able as capable of, and also list many of the able words like credible and affordable. You might also organize the able words in one column, the able words in another column, and underneath, write down the pattern or generalization that can help you remember when to spell words as able or able. Another wonderful resource that I use a lot is the free website OneLook.com. OneLook is a comprehensive dictionary website. When you input a word, it links you to a host of major, well-respected online dictionaries to choose from. OneLook also has a great reverse dictionary function, which I love. So let's say you're experiencing that tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon. You're trying to find a word that means an urge to travel, but can't quite put your finger on it. Well, just put in the concept, urge to travel. And up pops a host of possibilities like itchy feet and that adventurous word, wanderlust. Isn't that great? And perhaps my favorite feature of OneLook.com is the ability to search for words by specific affixes, roots, and even spelling patterns. For example, let's say you want to find words that have the struct root, meaning build, in it. Well, you put in struct, and out pops literally scores of struct words like construct, indestructible, structural, and infrastructure. All words carrying the core meaning of build. And how's that for a great search feature? And this powerful struct example is the perfect way to end our spelling lecture today, because it shows the power of our spelling system to carry meaning. And I hope by now I've convinced you that our spelling system is pretty darn rich and informative. All three layers of spelling information, alphabet, pattern, and meaning, build on each other toward our ultimate goal, building a better vocabulary.
Lecture 32, A Medley of New Words.
Do you remember the phrase Hobson's choice? It refers to a choice that is really no choice at all, a take-it-or-leave-it situation. Well, if you remember the phrase, I hope you also remember the great story of its origin, the story of Thomas Hobson and his stables. You may also remember that we introduced Hobson's Choice in what I called a grab bag lecture. And since I had so much fun with that first grab bag lecture, I thought we'd do one more. So, let's reach into our bag of words and see what we can come up with. Okay, first up is the word truckle. And for this word, I'm going to share a story about my brother, Colin. Now, I usually give examples to illustrate a word's meaning, but Colin's a great example because he shows exactly what this word is not. As you'll soon see, my brother Colin does not truckle to people that he disagrees with. Now, growing up, one of Colin's best friends was a boy who had a disease that caused him to lose his hair. And unfortunately, not all of this boy's classmates were sympathetic. And a few of the older students would tease and bully Colin's friend, slapping his head and calling him baldy. Now, as long as I can remember, Colin has never been one to shy away from standing up against something or someone that he believed was wrong. And that's something I still admire about my brother. So as usual, Colin stood up to the older bullies, knowing he'd probably get into a scrap. And sure enough, they told him to get lost. But my brother refused to truckle to these bullies. He stood by his friend, even at the risk of physical harm. So, if Colin's behavior shows the opposite of truckling, what's the basic meaning of our first target word? Well, as you can probably figure out, truckle is a verb that means to submit, to be servile and submissive. Truckle can also mean to fawn, to curry favor by flattering and sucking up. And truckle's often followed by its collocate, too, in phrases like truckle to those in power and truckle to another country's demands. Now, if you think back to our lecture on pride and false humility, you might pair the word truckle with all those obsequious sycophants who try to wheedle others with their blandishments. Now, truckle originally meant to, get this, sleep in a truckle bed. And what's a truckle bed, you ask? Well, it's just another name for a trundle bed. It's a small bed on casters that you can push under a larger bed to stow away when you're not using it. So in the old days, who usually slept in truckle beds? Servants. People who needed to be close by if their masters needed them. So folks who slept on truckle beds occupied the lower position. And when you're lying down in a lower position to someone else, you're truckling to them, submitting or yielding to them. So to remember truckle, think of someone you know who's always yielding to others. These weaklings either can't or won't stand up for themselves. Maybe it's a character in a book or a movie or someone you know. Make a personal connection and tell this truckling person to go get a spine. All right. Let's reach back into our grab bag to get our next target word, and it is tendentious. Have you heard the word tendentious before? What do you think it means? Well, let me tell you a story to see if that helps. Now, as part of my job, I present workshops on effective literacy instruction to schools, particularly on spelling and vocabulary assessment and instruction. And after these workshops, I get the chance to meet and talk with many incredibly effective and inspiring educators. I'm often in awe of what they do and learn as much from them as I hope that they do from me. However, there was one time after a workshop when I was cornered by someone with an agenda, although I didn't realize it right away. This individual asked me what type of literacy instruction I would recommend for students who struggle to read. Now, this is a huge and complex question. So, I recommended that he find a certified reading specialist who could assess the student's literacy development and skills, identify their strengths and areas of need, and design instructional plans based on each student's individual needs. And I explained to him that not all students who struggle to read experience the same difficulties. For example, some people may read the text fluently. However, when you ask these students to discuss the concepts in the text, you realize that they're struggling to comprehend what they've read. And other students present a completely different profile. These students may have trouble decoding the words and read haltingly. However, if you read the text aloud to them, without having to decode the words themselves, their comprehension can actually be very strong. So now, as I was explaining these different reading profiles to this man, I realized something. Do you ever look at someone you're talking to and realize from their facial expression that they're really not listening to you? What they're doing is just waiting for your lips to stop moving so they can make their next brilliant point? Well, that's the feeling that I was getting. And as soon as I stopped talking, he said something like this. Well, I was thinking that my students could really use the XYZ reading program. And he went on to describe all the benefits of this particular program. Now, I was familiar with the XYZ program. It was a program that targeted one particular literacy need, but would not meet the needs of a diverse range of students. So I told the man as much. I also mentioned other instructional approaches that might address a diverse range of students and their needs. I even tried to diplomatically refer him to some research that demonstrated the limitations of his XYZ program. However, he didn't want to hear it. He went on and on about his XYZ reading program, how this program was the panacea for all students who struggle to read. Now, I'm certainly not against programs. In fact, I think a well-designed literacy program can be an important tool for a teacher. However, I told this gentleman that programs are tools and that the most important factor in working with students who struggle to read is the quality of the teacher. That's because it's the teacher who is the one who actually implements the program. And I borrowed a phrase from my good friend, Dr. Sharon Walpole, who said, programs don't teach students, teachers teach students. I mean, have you ever experienced two teachers using the exact same textbook? One can be absolutely fantastic, and the other teacher right down the hall, maybe a first-year teacher, may not be quite as effective. Both teachers have the same tool, the same program, but their students walk away with entirely different educational experiences. Well, this person replied, okay, but I think the XYZ program is really the one for me. And all of this brings us to the definition of our target word, tendentious. Tendentious is an adjective meaning marked by or favoring a particular point of view, showing a definite tendency, bias, or purpose. Partisan. Just like the man I was talking to after the conference, his tendentious argument in favor of the XYZ reading program was a bit infuriating to me. He wasn't willing to listen to other approaches or even the research I mentioned. He was holding on to his viewpoint. And even before he asked me for advice, he'd already made up his mind. So with tendentious, the viewpoint espoused by the person is often a controversial one. So, how can we remember tendentious? Let's use the related word strategy. Is there a related word you already know that looks and sounds like tendentious? If you said tendency, you are correct. Tendentious is related to tendency, which comes from the medieval Latin noun tendentia, meaning inclination, leaning. When you're leaning toward one viewpoint, perhaps leaning so far that you can't see any of the other viewpoints, you become biased and tendentious. That's a great visual. And the T-E-N in tendentious also makes me think of the word tenet. A tenet is a principle, belief, or doctrine held to be true, often by members of a group or profession. Now, did you notice that the word held was in tenet's definition? Well, that's because tenet comes from the Latin verb tenet, literally meaning he holds. So this gives us a lot of memory hooks. In your vocabulary notebook, highlight the T-E-N-D in tendentious and connect it to tendency. Write down that a tendentious person has the tendency to hold tenaciously to their bias or purpose. They won't let go. Draw a picture of a stick figure holding the words belief or tenet. That's why someone with tendentious views can't receive anyone else's ideas. They're too busy holding on to their own. Okay, for our next set of target words, I want you to open your ears. Are you listening? Okay, here we go. Tintinnabulation. Susurration. Harumph. English has some wonderful sounding words for different types of sounds. And the three words we're going to tackle as a set, tintinnabulation, susurration, and harumph, are all onomatopoeic. They sound like the sounds that they refer to. So let's have a little bit of fun as we briefly cover each of these three sound words. First, tintinnabulation. What sound do you hear? Say it with me. Tintinnabulation. Can you hear the bells ringing in your ears yet? Tintinnabulation is a noun referring to the ringing, tinkling, or jingling sound, particularly the sound of bells. You may hear the tintinnabulation of church bells on Sunday morning.